are free, but I remind you that we are dependent on the financial support of our members, and I would urge you to join the Institute if you have not already done so, and of course donations are also gratefully received, and membership fees and donations are tax deductible. Before introducing tonight's speaker, may I remind you that next Saturday night, Dr. Burton Richter, the director of the Stanford Nuclear Accelerator, will give a lecture on energy in the 21st century. Tonight, our guest is a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor, Dr. Domna Stanton. Dr. Stanton is a distinguished professor in the Department of French at the City University of New York. Professor Stanton is a specialist in 17th and 18th century French studies, and she has made important contributions to feminist and comparative literary and cultural studies. She was instrumental in stimulating interest in the diversity of women's autobiography with The Female Autograph, a collection that she edited in 1987. She is the author of numerous articles on a wide and intriguing range of subjects and several books, including most recently Women Writ, Women Writing, Gender Discourse and Difference in 18th Century France. Dr. Stanton has lectured widely, and tonight's lecture is the fourth that she will be giving this week at UBC as a Green visiting professor. Her topic tonight is The Nation as Its Others, Protestants and Women in the Age of Louis XIV. Professor Stanton.
Good evening. It's very nice to be here. And I hope as we talk about the nation under Louis XIV, over the next hour, that you will also be thinking more broadly and relevantly about the nation today. In his innovative and rightly influential study of imagined communities, Benedict Anderson iterates the widespread notion that the nation, nationality, nationness, nationalism, and other such artifacts were created at the end of the 18th century. The concept was born in an age in which enlightenment and revolution were destroying the legitimacy of the divinely ordained hierarchical dynastic realm, unquote. While agreeing that no scientific definition of the nation can be devised, is there any way to get more light here? It's a little bit dark for me.
Well, why don't you put the house lights up temporarily?
Okay, great. How do I do that? Sorry. Okay. I think what it is that reflection of that thing. Thank you. Okay. While agreeing that no scientific definition of the nation can be devised, Anderson insists, like others before him, that the belief in a national community with finite boundaries among the peoples of Europe is historically related, on the one hand, to the loss or ebbing of a sacred script and language, a divine dynasty or king, and the confusion between cosmological and historical time, and on the other, to the rise of print capitalism, which gave a fixity to language and a vernacular tongue for state institutions and administrations. It is imagined as a community, he concludes, because, and I quote again, regardless of the actual inequality and exploitation.
Somebody turn up the volume,
please. I'm so sorry. Thank you. Thank you for telling me. Yes. Okay. Is that better, or should we turn it up?
Okay. The tech actually will hear you say if you ask him to turn it up.
Mr. or Ms. Technology Person, can you turn up the volume? Is that better? Okay. Should I start again? Start again or keep going? Okay. Sorry for those that have already heard it. In his innovative and rightly influential study of imagined communities, Benedict Anderson iterates the widespread notion that the nation, nationality, nationness, nationalism, and other such artifacts were created at the end of the 18th century. I quote, "The concept was born in an age in which enlightenment and revolution were destroying the legitimacy of the divinely ordained hierarchical dynastic realm," unquote. While agreeing that no scientific definition of the nation can be devised, Anderson insists, like others before him, that the belief in a national community with finite boundaries among the peoples of Europe is historically related, on the one hand, to the loss or ebbing of a sacred script and language, a divine dynasty or king, and the confusion between cosmological and historical time, and on the other, to the rise of print capitalism, which gave a fixity to language and a vernacular tongue for state institutions and administrations. It is imagined as a community, he concludes, because, I quote, regardless of the actual inequality and exploitation that may prevail in each, the nation is always conceived as a deep horizontal comradeship, unquote. Not surprisingly, are we okay back there? Not surprisingly, Anderson's model for the creation of the nation has come under attack. Homi Bhabha, for example, criticizes Anderson's lack of recognition of the internal splits, dissidences, and cultural differences that resist and contradict the totalizing myth of the homogeneous community, and that must therefore be forgotten or repressed to sustain the idea of the nation. Moreover, Bhabha rejects the historicism of analysts of the nation, such as Anderson, to highlight the contingent and arbitrary symbols, the scraps, patches, and rags of daily life, he says, that are turned into the signs of national culture, and no less important, the narrative performances that interpolate a growing circle of national subjects through the will to nationhood. Over and beyond postcolonial theorists such as Bhabha, early modern historians and literary critics have challenged the historical and ideological blind spot of Anderson and others. For example, they question the tendency to define the nation only in terms of the individualistic libertarian model emerging out of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, thereby occluding, as Carla Hess and Thomas LeCur observe, other histories of national identity that are not concerned with the nation-state or that are inscribed in discourses and practices devoid of notions of democracy and sovereignty. In particular, Renaissance scholars have made the case for the emergence of the idea of the nation during the reign of Elizabeth I of England. Typically, Adrian Hastings shows the significance of vernacular literature and print culture in the creation of nationness during Elizabeth's reign, although he also highlights the role of biblical Christianity in constructing the particular histories of European nations. Claire McEachern emphasizes the importance of Reformation culture in the Elizabethan notion of nation. Indeed, she argues for a performative ideal of social unity founded on affiliations among crown, church, and land that the monarchy forged, in opposition to Anderson's homogeneous horizontal comradeship, which she regards as a naive myth. And David Halgerson details the importance of other factors: poetry, drama, and choreographic antiquarian study, religion and the law, trade, colonial expansion, and other forms of economic activity as critical to the national enterprise in Elizabeth's reign. In a surprisingly chauvinistic turn, however, most of these Renaissance scholars claim the nationness existed in England, but nowhere else in early modern Europe for 200 years. You know the English, right? It did not exist among the French, according to this argument, because they were not as united by language or by territory, and because they did not fear their tyrannical rulers as the English did, notes Leah Greenfield. Ironically, this narrative replays the enmity to France, which was a constituent feature of English national identity, another against which England could define itself, as Linda Gregerson shows in examining each English writer's representation of the French language as a diabolically serpentine language, the pox as a French disease, and as Greenfield reminds us more generally, of France in the age of Reformation as a papistic Roman nation. Predictably, perhaps, I want to argue for the will to nationness and the creation of a national consciousness in 17th century France, undertaken first and foremost by an absolutistic monarch and his vast state machine. In Louis XIV's own words, the nation does not constitute a body in France, it resides wholly in the person of the king. In emphasizing elements that bound the ever more centralized state into a nation, and that emanated from a center that was believed to rule by divine right, I will be disagreeing with some aspects of Anderson's model and showing that others were already operative in 17th century France. But in addition, I will briefly try to show that groups that felt excluded from or oppressed by the monarchy's centralized nation-building and empire-building enterprise, including nobles who saw their traditional material and symbolic prerogatives disappear and be granted to a statewide bureaucracy instituted by Louis, deployed the idea of the French nation as distinct from the king they deemed tyrannical. Even more important, I will be arguing that in a nation consciously erected on the idea of one faith, one king, one law, the motto of Louis XIV's monarchy, there was systematic opposition to any group that was not thought to resemble the imagined one and the same. In other words, opposition to difference, multiplicity, heterogeneity, or hybridity. As with Jews and Sodomites, for example, about whom I've spoken earlier this week, difference from heterosexual Christianity spelled disorder in the politically convulsive 17th century sense of that term, which had been dramatized during the civil wars of the Fronde, which are 1648 to 1653. I began to cast my eyes over all the diverse parts of the state with the eyes of a master, Louis XIV writes in the opening pages of his memoirs for the year 1661. Disorder reigned everywhere. More specifically, I will be arguing that the idea of the nation was, and unfortunately still is, predicated on the existence of the other, on a number of others who are made only to be excluded. As Simone de Beauvoir wrote following a reading of Hegel, no collectivity defines itself as one without immediately setting the other opposite itself. In his Nations Before Nationalism, Paul Armstrong concurs from a sociological and anthropological perspective. I quote, "Anthropological historians have been increasingly obliged to confront the fact that groups tend to define themselves not by reference to their own characteristics, but by exclusion, that is, by comparison to strangers." He goes on to cite Emile Benveniste's linguistic notion, and I'm quoting again, that every name of an ethnic character in ancient times was differentiated and oppositional. There was present in the name which a people assumed the intention of distinguishing itself from the neighboring peoples. Hence, the ethnic group often constituted an antithetical duality with the opposed ethnic group, unquote. This is all the more prevalent, I would say, in a nation that had defined itself as absolute, as Louis Marin observes of Louis XIV. I'm quoting again, "The absolute always presumes a relative to which he must be compared to be greater than all greatness. A comparison between the absolute and the others is necessary for the absolute to see himself and to affirm himself as incomparable," unquote. Now, by this constitutive alterity, I do not only mean others outside of France's borders, although they clearly mattered, as the consistently negative representation of Italy, perhaps because of its cultural eminence since the Middle Ages, and Spain, France's oldest virtually hereditary enemy, confirm. Nor do I only mean the construction of the primitive, pagan, cannibalistic savage of the French colonies of the New World, radically othered in the infamous Code Noir, but also branded, subjected with the mark of the national fleur de lis. In the Code Noir, you read that any punishment was actually settled by branding the French fleur de lis on the shoulders of the slave. So, subjected with the mark of the national fleur de lis, although that indigenous figure, too, played a crucial part in differentiating and thus defining the Christian, civilized French self. I do mean to explore this evening, in a necessarily sketchy manner, the other within in two particular manifestations: Protestants, or the primary religious other, and more subtly, women, or the gendered other. For these and other others, the Jew and the Sodomite, for instance, were fabricated to define the symbolic limits of exteriority to the 17th century French imagination on the grounds that their incorporation would contaminate its integrity and destroy its unity. And yet, the exclusion and repudiation of such others, who are constructed by a set of oppositional traits, is precisely what creates an outside and thus an inside. Indeed, that binds together those who are or become part of the imagination. This notion of the other within, who is defined as without, and of the arbitrary and unsustainable distinctions between the within and the without, has appeared in various sites in contemporary critical theory, in continental deconstruction, in Edward Said's Orientalism, postcolonialist and subaltern studies. But it has also been highlighted as central to nation formation from the 17th century on. As Peter Salins writes in his study of boundaries, The Making of France and Spain in the Pyrenees, I quote here, national identity is a socially constructed and continuous process of defining friend and enemy, a logical extension of the process of maintaining boundaries between us and them. National identities constructed of the basis of such an oppositional structure do not depend on the existence of any objective linguistic or cultural differentiation, but on the subjective experience of difference. In this sense, national identity is contingent and relational. It is defined by the social or territorial, and I would add cultural, boundaries drawn to distinguish the collective self and its implicit negation, the other, unquote. One king, Louis XIV, one faith, Gallican Catholicism, and one law, and for my purposes this evening, the Salic law that was foundational to constituting France as a kingdom, these were some of the elements that, by identification with the same and by opposition to the other, were used to construct the imagination of 17th century France. In the memoirs for the instruction of his son, Louis XIV emphasizes that the only way he could effect deep-seated reforms throughout the kingdom was, and I quote, to make my will supreme by conduct that would inspire submission and respect, and at the same time to grant graces freely and without compulsion whenever and to whomever I would please, unquote. As he engaged in the massive work of centralization in the wake of the civil wars of the Fronde, Louis worked to transform a feudal society dominated by an individualistic noblesse d'épée, nobility, into a nation complete with new administrative structure of powerful intendants or intendants dispensed throughout the land, a professional army with homogeneous uniforms for the soldiers, and a parlement that, after its defeat in the Fronde, acceded to the idea of the king's absolute power and thus its own irrelevance, an idea that the monarchy's jurists propagated over the course of the 17th century. As Charles Loiseau wrote in his Traité des Seigneuries, Treatises on Lordship, 1610, sovereignty consists of absolute power that is perfect and complete power in all ways. Thus, this power has no degrees of superiority, no limitation of time. Just as a crown cannot be complete if its circle is not whole, so too sovereignty does not exist if it lacks a single thing, unquote. Or as Lebré put it succinctly in the De la Souveraineté des Rois, which is on the sovereignty of kings, 1632, arguing against any form of shared power, sovereignty is no more divisible than the point in geometry. Indeed, no more than God, whose representative on earth Louis XIV was upheld to be by a theory of divine right elaborated over the 100 years before he assumed power. But as Louis XIV emphasized in his memoirs, his will to absolute sovereignty was to be sustained by grace, by beneficence and munificence, by numerous forms of representation and symbols that he understood how to manipulate better than any monarch before him to achieve both personal and social cohesion, probably better than most of our presidents, at least in the United States. As Louis Marin has argued convincingly, Louis XIV's absolutism existed in and through forms of representation and illusion that elicited something close to religious belief. More concretely, Peter Burke has shown that the fabrication of Louis XIV did not only involve musicians and choreographers of the court ballets in which the king danced, the masters of ceremonies who supervised the coronation, the royal entries and other public rituals, and the painters, sculptors, and engravers who produced his portrait. Let me show you his most famous portrait, which you can see in the Louvre. This is the famous 1701 portrait by Rigaud. I'm sorry that, see if I can do this for 1 second. Turn out the light. Can you see that back there? Not really. Should I lower this just a tad?
I think so, yeah. Now let's see if I can.
Pardon me?
Can we turn that up?
This is this very famous portrait at the Louvre, which has this, you know, very curious, you position yourself, you must position yourself basically beneath it, looking up at, you know, through his legs. Pardon me? Oh, I see. All this technology here. So the position that you have to put yourself in, literally down below, looking up at what he obviously is very proud of his legs, which danced in ballets of the court, and in fact that is a standard dueling position, not just a balletic position. Oh, it doesn't matter. Let me put on the next one also. By Burke's count, do you want to put the next one on for me? Thank you. By Burke's count, there are 671 engravings of Louis XIV in the Cabinet des Estampes of the Bibliothèque Nationale, 287 datable Finnish portraits, and 334 medals commemorating events of the reign, whose production was overseen by a special Académie des Inscriptions. And this does not begin to list all of the writers, many of them living off kingly pensions, all of them eager for his favors, who extol Louis XIV from the beginning to the end of his reign as the greatest monarch of the world. Symptomatically, then, Molière would end the Bourgeois Gentilhomme, a comédie ballet commissioned for the court, with a well-known Ballet des Nations, Ballet of Nations, that mock foreign others, only to bring them together in the end to applaud the glory of the king. And this is one of endless numbers of portraits showing Louis, obviously, as the patron of the arts, as you can see there. I'm going to be talking about globes a little bit later on, so remember the globe. In the decades-long Querelle des Anciens, et des modernes, the quarrel of the ancients and the moderns, Louis was cast as the incarnation of the ideal modern nation state. For example, in Charles Perrault's Le siècle de Louis le Grand, the century of Louis le Grand, read before the Académie Française in 1687, this lengthy poem, which pits the modern adorers of the all-powerful monarch against them who wrongly adore the ancients, details the advances in science and law, the extraordinary production of drama, painting and sculpture, architecture, landscaping, and above all music, as the defining terms of the French nation and of modernity. The two terms are made synonymous in the poem. And just as Perrault hails Louis as superior to Caesar and Alexander, and implicitly Augustus, since his dominion encompasses the entire century, Versailles itself, and I quote here from this poem, is not a palace, it is an entire city. No, it is more accurately a world where the various miracles of a great universe have been assembled. I'm going to skip the next one and go straight to the Versailles one, which would be number 4. The splendors and stupendous festivals of Versailles. I'm going to show you one image here, which is from a 1674 festival. And of course, Louis is in the middle, right under the tent. These were supposedly extraordinary fireworks, a kind of pharaonic symbol in the middle, and so forth. And of course, not only did these festivals take place, but they were immediately reproduced and disseminated. The splendors and stupendous festivals of Versailles, which were extolled in every way and mediatic form, was the metonymic emblem of Louis, the king cast as the unique, eternal, and ubiquitous sun that gives light and life to everything it touches, as Louis himself notes in his memoirs. Next image, please. As you know, probably know, Louis cast himself as the sun king, sun god, and he often dressed in court ballets. Oops, wrong way. There he is, as the sun. This massive production and dissemination of representations was coupled with the vast effort to both extend and enclose the inside of France, to constitute the nation's territorial identity and thus its outside. In his 1690 dictionary, Furtier highlighted the territorial imperative of nationhood in his primary definition of nation as, I quote, a great people inhabiting certain expansive land contained within certain boundaries, unquote. Striving to ever expand these boundaries, Louis waged constant campaigns to recuperate ancient provinces, conquer and assimilate new ones, and wage continental wars and continual wars to turn nation into empire, whatever the economic and human cost. Although this would eventually leave France in a state of financial crisis, with a restive population and powerfully critical voices, such as that of Bishop Fénelon, in 1687, Perrault was to write the last 70 verses of Le Siècle de Louis XIV, the century of Louis the Great, as an apotheosis of Louis and an opposition between the almighty monarchic warrior, next slide please, and a series of others, beginning with the subjected proud peoples of the Ithro. This is Louis triumphing over his enemies. Can you see that back there? I'm sorry. Okay. Indeed, the speaker's insistence that, I quote, as far as Louis wishes, he extends his frontiers. In 10 days, he subjects entire provinces, casts both nation-building and imperial conquest in the miraculous note. At the same time, the super warrior image of Louis XIV is opposed to cruel, tyrannical others, I quote, whose haughty kings are so fantastic, fanatically vain of their destiny, a single gaze on them is punished with death, unquote. But only to establish the trope that even they are so charmed by Louis' reputation, they cross the ocean to render homage at his royal feet. At the same time, it became the monarchy's goal and the decades-long task of Sébastien le Prêtre de Vauban, the major architect of territorial France under Louis XIV, to construct a string of fortresses cities around the country's perimeter, notably along the vulnerable northern and eastern frontiers, and to contain its land within a ring of artificial barriers where natural features did not mark or protect it. Still, the material reality of this boundary work would have meant little to the French without its reconstruction in the maps, globes, and models of cities that the monarchy commissioned. Next, please. Louis even commissioned the Cassini family, not an Italian, right, to do great national survey, the first of its kind in Europe that would take some 50 years to complete. I wanted to point out, I'm sorry, I turn my head and then I lose you. But I wanted to point out in the center is the Dauphin. There is his wife and the mother on either side. But what is important here is, of course, the maps that are supposedly unfurled, if you see on either side of the king. And these are registering territorial acquisitions of two cities in particular. In the meantime, the monarchy's aim was to depict France as a singular location, what Vauban called un précaré, that is to say, a term that suggests an arable meadow with a dueling or warring implications set off in a square, orderly form. As Chandra Mukherjee has written, these maps, models, globes, and other artifacts did not only help to coordinate the movements of the king's armies, they also guided the travels of his mercantile companies and his religious missionaries toward the Orient and the New World. Next slide, please. I couldn't, of course, resist this. This is actually from 1643, a map of Canada. Now, although Anderson emphasizes the role of the map and the census for the creation of imagined communities in the 19th century, he does not examine the dramatic increase in the 16th and 17th century of the production and dissemination of ever more sophisticated maps, which serve to give visual reality to the idea of a nation of subjects for insiders and outsiders alike. Transformed first by Euclidean and then by descriptive geometry, these maps were presented as the emblem of truth and objectivity, in denial of their homogenizing representation of heterogeneous places on the same plane, and their inscription of the norms and values of the social and political hierarchy. Examining the map of Paris that Jacques Gombos presented to Louis XIV in 1652, Louis Marin notes, the order of its rational method and the political order of the absolute monarchy conspire to the same rhythm. Gombos himself expressed the hope, I'm quoting here, that by making the map public, it would have a favorable welcome by all nations where the king's glory and name can be carried by his humble and obliging servant. The print culture that ensured the circulation of maps also disseminated works and documents in the vernacular language in ever greater numbers from the mid-16th century on. One admittedly imperfect measure of this increase is the list of individual works published annually that the Bibliothèque Nationale had conserved. It numbered 60 in 1601 and rose to 260 by 1666. Whereas Anderson claims that the pre-bourgeois ruling classes created their cohesion outside of language, or at least outside print language, it could be argued that France was bound officially by a language in 1539, in Francis I's Ordinance of Villers-Cotterêts, which required that all legal documents be written, I quote, in maternal French language and not otherwise, thus making it the nation's official idiom. By 1694, the first Dictionnaire de l'Académie Française could stipulate the nation comprises, I quote, all of the inhabitants of the same state, of the same country, who live under the same laws and use the same language. The Académie Française highlighted the role of its common language not only for the nation's subjects, but even more important for the preeminence of France throughout the world. According to an academician during Louis XIV's reign, Richelieu, the founder and supporter of the Académie, next figure please, derived from the outset, I'm quoting here while his image goes up, this is again a very famous portrait which is in the Louvre of Richelieu. A certain degree of eloquence in a nation signals the superiority of innate talent that foreigners respect. He knew that to extend one's language is in some ways to extend one's nation, I'm still quoting, since nations are distinguished from one another by the difference of languages more than by the widest rivers and the highest mountains, that if language does not mean making actual conquests, it does perhaps pave the way for them as it establishes and naturalizes its new subjects, unquote. This dream of linguistic colonization was first directed within. The Académie Française understood, stated Pélisson and d'Olivet, the 17th century academician who wrote its history, that its task was, I quote again, to clean the language of the filth that it had contracted, either from the mouths of common people or from the mob at the law courts, and the impurities of pettifogging lawyers, lawyers had a bad name then too, or from the bad use of terms from ignorant courtiers or by the abuse of those who corrupt the language when they write it and from those in the pulpits who say what they should but otherwise than they should, unquote. This national linguistic effort toward purity, with its class and racial connotations, was conducted in part by codifying what Vaugelas termed in his influential Remarks on the French Language, 1647, le bon usage of the court and the city, the court and the salon, for the social and intellectual elites of the country, what came to be extolled as the pure, clear, pithy, urbane, polished, and elegant idiom of les honnêtes gens in speech of writing. Les honnêtes gens doesn't mean honest, it means courtly folk. In addition, however, the imaginary homogeneous elite that 17th century authors called la cour et la ville, the court and the city, and all of those others throughout the land who aspired to be part of it, or at least to emulate it, strove to eliminate what the two interlocutors in Perrault's Parallel of the Ancients and the Moderns, 1688, pejoratively dub this variety of dialects in favor of pure French, or better yet, the language of the court. In a kingdom, language is like money, they explain. To be acceptable, both must bear the prince's stamp. As Bernard Manier has shown, the project of substituting the French of la cour et la ville for the provincial languages and dialects was not only furthered by royal edicts, it was zealously assumed by the network of regional academies at Arles, Nîmes, and Caen, for example, even though, as René Balibar and Dominique Laporte have concluded, this linguistic terrorism would only be completed after the French Revolution. Indeed, from the mid-16th century on, a national impulse, exemplified by Du Bellay's 1549 Defense and Illustration of the French Language, exhorted the French to make their tongue as worthy as imperial and sacred Latin. Throughout the 17th century, this impulse translated into a triumphant assertions of superiority in such works as Le Laboureur's The Advantages of the French Language over the Latin, 1657, and Desmarais de Saint-Sorlin's Comparison of the Language and Poetry of France with Greek and Latin, 1670. It finds a heated expression in the quarrel initiated by those who wish to eliminate the use of Latin inscriptions on the plethora of medals and statues produced of Louis XIV. And its crowning version in Dominique Bourg's 1674 Conversations between Ariste and Eugène on the French language. This conversation's interlocutors detail the supremacy of French over all other foreign tongues, including Latin and Greek, Italian and Spanish, even Chinese, whose deficiencies are enumerated because of its characteristic clarity, polish, and purity, which reflects the character of the nation. Unlike the conquered nations of the Roman Empire, which were forced to learn Latin after their subjugation, says Eugène, French is beloved even of those, I'm quoting here, who hate our nation the most. In this, even the people of those nations, as common as they are, have the taste of the honnêtes gens. They learn our language almost as quickly as their own, as if some secret instinct tells them, in spite of themselves, that one day they must obey the King of France as their legitimate master. Unquote. So doing, Bourg evokes but overcomes the image of the hating others, who instinctively know through and by the power of the French language that they will be, indeed that they already are, the conquered, the colonized, and thus the civilized subjects of Louis XIV. In the Entretien's closing paragraphs, the monarch is upheld as the exemplary embodiment of, I quote, the perfection of our language. From him, kings must learn to reign, but from him, peoples must learn to speak, unquote. As such superlatives suggest, Louis XIV, called Dieudonné, elected by God, was cast as the perfect speech incarnate, and in even more exalted tones as the transmitter of the divine logos. King by the divine right, with thaumaturgical powers like his predecessors. Next image, please. This is, in fact, an image of this purported power of all French kings to cure by miraculous touch. And this is Henry IV, who is touching the masses. The liturgical powers, then, and thus with the right to exact absolute obedience, Louis XIV and the French prelates defined France as the perfect Christian nation, elected by God, the purest and most long-lasting embodiment of the one true Catholic Church. As Louis Mambourg emphasized in his History of Calvinism, 1682, conformity to one faith as to one law constitutes a powerful form of cohesion. I quote, "And as we are all united in the most Christian monarchy by the bond of the same law, which obliges all of us equally to give inviolate obeisance to the only king that God has given us, I hope that we will also be united by the bond of the same faith and of the only true religion, which can only be found in the Apostolic Roman Catholic Church, the only pastoral of Jesus Christ." I don't have to tell you how many onlys there are in that quote. Even as Louis XIV and his prelates propagated a vision of France as the direct descendant of Charlemagne's Holy Roman Empire, they fiercely supported a church that was national in method and administration. In the wake of the Reformation, which broke the purported unity of Western Christianity and spurred the rise of national churches engaged in a massive effort to revitalize and reaffirm Catholic beliefs, the spirit of Gallicanism under Louis XIV reached a schismatic level with the papacy of Innocent XI after the promulgation of the Four Articles of the Gallican Church in 1682. In this ideological climate, French Protestantism, which the monarchy always referred to as the so-called reform religion, in French, la religion prétendue réformée, was easily cast as a heresy whose adherents were radically other, the antithesis of the proper Catholic national subject. Whereas Henry IV, who oversaw the promulgation of the Edict of Nantes in 1598, which permanently guaranteed the religious and civil rights of Huguenots in France, ascended the throne by proclaiming, "We are all French and fellow citizens of the same country." 17th century French monarchs depicted Protestants as the source of religious and therefore national disunity and disorder. For according to the logic by which uniformity is necessary for cohesion and strength, diversity or pluralism represents a terrifying weakness and must be discredited as the sign of the false. As Bossuet, the powerful Bishop of Meaux and a national orator, was to assert in his Histoire des Variations des Églises Protestantes, History of the Variations of the Protestant Churches, variation and diversity are proof of error and depravity, of a spirit of satanic individualism and division. Catholicism is unerring, he argued, precisely because it is unchanging and inflexible. In the religious politics and the political religiosity of Louis XIV's absolutism, Huguenots were defined not only as treacherously individualistic and disobedient to God's representative on the throne of France, but as traitors to the nation and thus its enemies. In Mambourg's words, Protestantism, I quote, is the most furious and the most terrible of all of the enemies that France has ever had, unquote. Although it would appear that the 1 million or so French Protestants, some 5 to 6% of the population, considered themselves French and proclaimed their loyalty to the king, they were viewed as erecting a threatening state within the nation, what Mambourg dubbed a type of republic established within the monarchy. After all, their religion had originated in Republican Geneva and the United Provinces. Fiercely Republican, they were said to have strong connections with the international reform movement. Potentially, then, they could aid and abet France's external enemies in case of war and endanger the nation at its imagined core. In his memoirs, however, Louis XIV does not represent the Protestants as the redoubtable monster of heresy, a trope in French discourse on Protestants since 1589. As is typical of the constructions of the scapegoat, he blames them for their alienation, their difference and distance from him, their paternalistic king. He explains that he wanted the partisan of the RPR, the Religion Prétendue Réformée, I'm quoting here, to consider from time to time if they had some good reason for depriving themselves willingly of the advantages they could share with all my other subjects, unquote, and urge the clergy to eliminate unnamed scandals that sometimes distance them from him. These are the scandals within the Catholic Church. But Louis XIV's memoirs also betray a more fearful vision of a great number, I'm quoting here, a great number of my subjects of the so-called Reformed religion who have a troubling doubleness as both Protestant and my subjects, and thus constitute a stain on his singular absolutism by divine right. Moreover, they are both ubiquitous and imperceptible. The Protestant corruption, he continues, I'm quoting, is not limited to a clearly defined number, but spread in all of the parts of the state. In fact, I quote again, people cannot possibly distinguish a well-disguised falsehood when it lies hidden among so many evident truths, unquote. In this phantasmatic scene of undefinable boundaries, they are everywhere but cannot clearly be distinguished, recognized, and classified as other, a terrifying prospect for a king obsessed with a clear and indisputable truth. Paradoxically, Louis articulates in his memoirs a policy of analogous doubleness towards the RPR. He will both maintain diseased Protestantism, as he calls it, which he needs as other to his healthy, pure nation, and attempt to transform it into the same by steadily eliminating the privileges accorded in the Edict of Nantes and eventually converting its adherents into proper Catholic subjects. Thus, on the one hand, Louis will issue a flood of restrictive decrees ranging from 12 in 1661 to 85 in the crucial period 1679 to 1685, 468 items in all, according to Charlotte Wells, while on the other, he will dole out powerful economic incentives for potential converts, which the Protestants excoriated as the buying of souls. He will underwrite a nationwide campaign to disseminate 1 million Catholic texts among the heretics and send the leading orators of the day on holy missions to the Protestants as so many latter-day crusaders. When the resistant Protestant failed even to pretend to become the Catholic same, unrestrained violence was unleashed by the dragoons of the Minister of War, supported by Bishop Bossuet's doctrine of compelle remanere, force them to remain, first propounded by St. Augustine. As reports proclaimed as many as 30,000 conversions a day, Louis came to believe, or so states one of his edicts, I quote, that presently we see with the proper gratitude that we owe to God that our efforts have achieved the goal that we set for ourselves, since the greatest and best part of our subjects of the said RPR have embraced Catholicism, unquote. The denial of division and fissures, which has been viewed as central to nation building from Ernest Renan to Benedict Anderson and to Homi Bhabha, seems to be part of a conscious monarchic strategy, as one of Louis' edicts suggests, the strategy of forgetting, erasing. I quote, we have decided that in order to erase completely from memory is to revoke completely the Edict of Nantes, unquote. Louis determined to efface from memory Protestant difference and division because it denied the unicity of faith and thus of the nation. And even more, his desire for power and glory greater than all of his predecessors who had to compromise with the religious other. Indeed, he wished for a more spectacular victory over heretics than the defeat of the Turks had given Emperor Leopold I in 1683. Thus, in 1685, Louis XIV issued the Edict of Fontainebleau, which denied all forms of assembly to Protestants, demolished its churches and schools, banished its ministers into exile if they did not convert, and prohibited all others from emigrating, binding them to the nation's territory until they became his true, docile Catholic subjects. The revocation of 1685 generated an outpouring of enthusiasm in France, spurred at least in part by the monarchy's propaganda. Next image, please. This is Louis as defender of the faith, as you can see. And I wish I actually had a pointer here. Can you hear me while I do this? Okay. What's important here is that you have the edict, the revocation, in the hand of victory. That's who that is. Actually, of justice, there's Victoria. Can you? Yep, thank you. And beneath it, what you have are these sort of almost Michelangelesque figures who are sort of doomed. Speaking of Michelangelo, there's Louis in the middle, and if you recall the Sistine Chapel, Look at the finger. It doesn't show up terribly well. Let me see if I can do this backwards. It's right there. Can you see that? And then on the right, you really are right at least, you have the burning of Protestant books down below. The clergy dubbed the instantaneous disappearance of an inveterate heresy nothing short of miraculous. The cultural elite entered the competition of the Académie Française in 1686 for the best poem on the destruction of heresy, and the court and the city joined Madame de Sévigné in declaring, "No king has ever done or will ever do anything more memorable." "Never had the people shown such joy," wrote the Abbé de Choisy in his memoirs. "In the streets, 100,000 voices shouted, 'Long live the king!'" But this universal acclaim was to be short-lived, as 200,000 Protestants left the nation, a diaspora that was to have profound consequences abroad, among which the resolve of Protestant states to attack France. Within France, the revocation and the massive Protestant exodus did not only cause a domestic economic disaster, as Colbert, the Minister of Finance, had warned. It exposed religious unity, which was foundational to the French nation, as a myth. Denounced in a plethora of Protestant pamphlets from the North, the falsehood paradoxically made France similar to Louis's own definition of the Protestant other as falsehood incarnate, and thus as the antithesis of divine truth. Moreover, it revealed that the proclaimed superiority of France over all other nations was based on barbaric violence, in ideological terms, that the nation was ruled not by right, but by force, as Pascal had observed in one of his fragmentary thoughts, Pensées, and thus that France was no better than the savages in the New World who played their part in the production of the civilized Frenchman. As Saint-Simon would write bitterly a half century after the revocation, Louis had perpetrated horrors that rivaled those of heretical and pagan tyrants against the early Christians. The totalitarian attempt to eliminate all difference, which is the stuff of psychosis, had turned Louis into the very other, the heretic against whom he defined the national subject. He had become the antithesis of the just ruler. The term tyrant dotted 17th century critiques of his absolutistic monarchy, and France had lost its claim to be the Christian nation elected by God. When Mambrou described Protestant psalms as having that certain air of a soft and effeminate song, which has nothing devout or majestic about it, as does the chant of the Catholic Church established by St. Gregory, he exposed the workings of gender ideology in the early modern, or for that matter, the postmodern period, that can devalue anything, including a deviant religion, by characterizing it as feminine or effeminate. Mambrou's claim that women, such as Catherine de Médicis, were the primary means by which Protestantism established itself in France, conjoined the religious and the gendered other, who throughout the various anti-woman discourses of the early modern Querelle des Femmes, quarrel on women, was invariably identified with Eve and thus with Satan as the agent of man's fall. Or as Dolivet, the author of a work called Alphabet of the Imperfections and Malices of Women, 1617, emphasized, the cause of all disorder. Bossuet, who dubbed Eve Adam's supernumerary bone, argued that, I'm quoting, nature wanted her to be in some sense subject to him. The superiority of wisdom resided in him, and Satan came to attack at the place or side that was least strong and the least fortified. By attacking Eve, the devil formed in woman one of the most dangerous weapons to destroy the human species. Indeed, in over half the world, women live in a kind of slavery. The harsh empire of husbands over them, the yoke to which woman is subjected, is an effect of her original sin. Unquote. These gender asymmetries of power, grounded in religious ideology, were part and parcel of a system of binary oppositions that justified the exclusion of women from monarchic succession in France, codified in Salic law. As Collett-Bone has shown, the Lex Salica, which in its initial 6th to 8th century formulation stated that male blood relatives were to receive landed property, the heritage of ancestors, and women only personal property, had become a major myth of national origins by the end of the 14th century. The myth privileged Pharamond as the one who made the beginning of the monarchy coincide with the institution of the Salic law, now redefined as the first statute that separated France from the laws of the empire and of other kingdoms. What had been a custom was recast as a royal statute, edict, constitution, or ordinance, and enthroned as the fundamental principle of the political structure of the kingdom. As Laurent Bouchel emphasized in 1615, I'm quoting here, it has in fact been said that the Salic law was the palladium of France, for just as the Trojans thought that their kingdom was firm and stable as long as they possessed their statue of Pallas, which if lost would lead to the destruction of their kingdom, so too the observance of the Salic law meant that the state was saved, and that if it happened that the law was abolished or removed, it would lead to the ultimate ruin of the state. This pervasive association of women and disorder, or the ruin of the kingdom, also encompassed the gendered asymmetries of power in marriage, to underscore the wisdom of Salic law. As Bossuet writes in his Politics Drawn from the Words of the Holy Scripture, the dignity of reigning houses among God's people, the Israelites, did not seem sufficiently well sustained in the person of a woman, who, after all, is obliged to take on a master when she marries, an argument voiced by jurists as well. Thus, the idea of a French queen who would necessarily have an exogamous marriage for political imperatives meant that a foreigner would effectively head the French nation, a possibility that horrified the jurist de Blois. I quote, "Our fathers never felt any greater horror than to be dominated by someone other than a prince of our nation," unquote. And that is why Moses has established this law, concluded Bossuet, "You will not establish over you a king from another nation." But other European nations, indeed both England and Spain, had queens at the head of state, a fact that French jurists and historians had to confront in defense of Salic law. Thus, de Blois wondered, if Salic law is not observed in Spain, England, Scotland, and some other places, does this mean that it is mutable, that it could be changed and subverted? Only to conclude somewhat shakily, I'm quoting here, that the other nations have different mores and attitudes, not that Salic law, our civil law, is not mutable. In a more defensive, aggressive posture, Bignon's On the Excellence of the Kings and the Kingdom of France, 1610, attacks a certain Lopez Madera, a quote here, who attempted to demonstrate in a long discourse that the succession of women to the throne is natural, and that the origins of Salic law is doubtful and uncertain. But only, claims Biron, because he wished, I quote again, to hide this defect and to provide some shadow for it, seeing that as a result of this practice, the dignity of the Spanish throne is greatly lessened. Moreover, in Castile, where women have perpetually succeeded to the throne, he continues, the kingdom has therefore been transferred to various foreign families. Indeed, since Charlemagne, only a few places in the West have weakened or abandoned the valor and virility of scepters, declares Bignon. Thus, rather than the Spaniards asking the French for the proof and the foundation of Salic law, they themselves should demonstrate the origin and the onset of the right of female crowns, since France has kept and continues the tradition of antiquity, and they, the Spaniards, have made the alteration. The Spanish, then, concludes Bignon with considerable satisfaction, numbers among, quote, the enemies of the French, and is at bottom truly envious of this prerogative of Salic law. That 50 years later, Sorel was still preferring a retort to the Spaniards' critique of Salic law and his treatise on the rights and the prerogatives of the kings of France, that he could not simply accept the fact that the monarchies of England and France were very different than ours, but reemphasized the inferiority of the Spanish monarchy as defective and far beneath ours because they do have female rulers, ultimately suggests an excess of discomfort with the difference of others, that no amount of iterations of superiority of the French monarch over all other kings can conceal. That the exclusion of female other is foundational to the nation state, and that her inclusion on the French throne would spell its destruction and ruin is a blatant, albeit extreme manifestation of deep-seated connections between misogynistic and nationalistic ideologies. George L. Moss has observed that the rise of nationalism in Europe was coterminous with construction of a bourgeois morality based on essentialized gender roles, manliness as activity and rationality, femininity as passivity and emotionality, were appropriated by nationalist ideology as a foundation on which to build national stereotypes, he argues, although he limits the existence of the nation to modern post-vote revolutionary times. In more general terms, Anne McClintock considers gendered symbolism a means for forming a nation. It is allegorized as feminine in a chivalric romance in which the citizen is the adoring man, or then the homeland is a virgin, penetrated, subdued, domesticated, and transformed into the motherland. In Jackie Stevens' views, the nation is tied to ideas of birth and ancestry. The word comes from the Latin natio, birth, personified as the goddess of birth, and by extension, tribe, race, people. And it represents itself through the gendered notions of reproduction and family in different historical periods. In the early modern period, the dominant notion of the patriarchal family gave rise to the circular logic that patriarchal monarchic authority was legitimate because it resembled the family structure, and conversely, that patriarchal family structure was legitimate because it resembled the monarchy. In keeping with a family-nation compact, the jurists and the clergy and the monarchy elaborated, as Sarah Hanley has shown, the early modern French family was brought under progressively more stringent patriarchal controls from the 16th to the 17th century in the areas of marriage, reproduction, dowry, inheritance, and marital separation in a way that systematically empowered the male head and disempowered women. It even reduced the autonomy of widows, who were the only females legally recognized as persons. In his Politique tirée des propres paroles de l'écriture sainte, politics taken from the words of the Holy Scripture, Bossuet thus iterates the conventional wisdom that the first idea of power that existed among men is the idea of paternal power. He continues, "We created kings on the model of fathers. The name of the king is the name of father." Not surprisingly, then, the patriarchal romance of French monarchic nationhood, predicated on the exclusion of the gendered other, cast even the temporary and limited assumption of monarchic power by female regents in the period 1460 to 1650 in images of catastrophic monstrousness. Next image. This is one of my favorites. Very briefly, you see that, in fact, on the right, you have the kneeling woman, which is supposed to be, according to this image, her proper place. And on the left, you have the trope of the world reversed, where, in fact, you have the women with the men kneeling. And notice, please, the woman's hair and the difference between the hair on the two women, because on this one, of course, her hair is out to here, which is always the sign of dissolute sexuality. In the middle, you have, of course, this monstrous being, and the legend says that she, the woman, is a monster who is an angel in church and a devil at home. Accordingly, structures against women in any position of power also proliferated in the 17th century, specifically after the Wars of the Fronde, in which some aristocratic women, including Mademoiselle de Montpensier, Louis XIV's cousin, played a part. In one form or another, jurists and ecclesiastics, as well as secular writers, iterated the rigidly gendered views of Baudin's seminal The Six Books of the Republic, 1577. I quote, "The law prohibited women from assuming any of the responsibilities and offices that belong to men, not only because of their lack of prudence, but inasmuch as virile actions are contrary to the female sex and to feminine modesty and chastity," unquote. The forceful exclusion of elite women from the public sphere after the Fronde, along with their progressive loss of power in the patriarchal family, and the elaboration of a compelling ideology of maternity. I've worked on this in another moment. There is around 1650 this convergence of any number of texts pushing women out of the public sphere and back into the domestic. So this compelling ideology of maternity, along with these other factors, have been dubbed, after Michel Foucault, the great enclosure of women. It affected all elite women, even those who had gained social, intellectual, and artistic prestige in the salons they founded and frequented in the first half of the century, sites of female preeminence that Louis XIV came to see as a breeding ground for the civil wars of the Fronde, it has been said, and that he made sure to displace and efface by the aesthetic attractions and economic incentives of life at Versailles. To be sure, women continued to play a significant role as writers, although now their treatises expressed pro-woman arguments in more attenuated form, and their works of fiction strategically used ironic or double-voiced discourse, or perhaps historical displacement, to veil critiques of the monarch. It seems clear, however, that they recognized their exclusion from the nation-state. As one of the characters of Madeleine de Scudéry, the most successful novelist and salonnière of the century, perhaps because she understood the limits of the sayable of what can be said in the reign of Louis XIV, as she remarks in her essay on the passions that men have invented, "I have seen 100 times persons of my sex so interested in the good and bad exploits of the prince that they would say, 'We defeated the enemies,' forgetting that they had no part whatever in the state," unquote. In this sense, too, I would argue, Benedict Anderson's vision of the nation applies to 17th century France when he speaks consciously, or more likely unconsciously, I'm quoting here, of the deep horizontal comradeship, the fraternity that constitutes the invented nation. To be sure, the creation and perpetuation of national identity and consciousness through various constructions of the excluded other, gendered or religious, or for that matter, ethnic and sexual, is precarious. The differences between us and them tend to recede or fade over time. Do you want to turn it off for a second? This can produce phantasms of contamination by the impure, or the specter of monstrous hybridity that destabilize the foundational myths of the unique nation. Or then, the them, like the Protestants, are forced to display signs that they have converted into or assimilated as we, which we both impose, mistrust, and disbelieve. Those whom Louis XIV had proclaimed converted posed the ubiquitous threat that their faithful submission was only a performance, a spectacular show that hid a different truth within. At the same time, the demonized Huguenot who refused to convert was exiled from the nation only to proliferate discourses from afar that declared Louis XIV's France to be the nation unie prétendue, the pretended united nation. And no matter how reenclosed within the domestic sphere of marriage and maternity, the gendered other always carried the Eve-like threat of disordering and ruining the nation, causing patriarchal catastrophes like so many Clytemnestras, or for that matter, Helens. Indeed, the patriarchal effort to confine Helen to monogamy is depicted as foundational to the Greek nation in Racine's Iphigenie, a play commissioned for the great festival of Versailles in 1674. In fact, that's what I showed you earlier. But this patriarchal effort only leads in Racine's play to erotic infidelity that forces the Greeks to go on a cataclysmic war in the name of the nation, namely the Trojan War. Even more important, the fear that gender binarity is unsustainable, that the lines between the superordinate masculine and the subordinate feminine all too readily blur and merge, emerges in different guises in 17th century France, including strictures against cross-dressing, which went so far as to condemn Joan of Arc, the woman who attempts to save the nation against the English, for failing to resume feminine dress during her imprisonment and her eventual martyrdom at the stake. She should have been wearing a skirt. Above all, however, the fear of gender fluidity is dramatized in the 17th century by the phantasmatic proliferation of hermaphrodites, who were regarded as monstrous for confusing to the point of undecidability the boundaries between the genders. People are seeing hermaphrodites everywhere in this period. Even the threat of death to which hermaphrodites were subjected could never ensure, however, what other body lay behind the appearance of gender sameness. Inevitably, perhaps, it was not only they who could not stay fixed as other, it was we as well. For as Louis XIV bounded and centralized France and worked to forge a nation of obedient subjects, we articulated various forms of resistance and in the process deployed the idea of nation over and against a tyrannical king. Thus, the Duc de Boulainvilliers' Essays on the Nobility of France, containing a dissertation on its origin and debasement, is a call to the aristocracy to remember that after the conquest of Gaul, they were all equals, that they elected their kings as nothing more than civil magistrates, because freedom was, I quote, the first condition of the French nation, and that if the kingdom has flourished, it was because of the blood and work of the ancient nobility, unquote. Indeed, the only powers given to Clovis, argues Boulainvilliers, was to sustain this liberty, defend it, and work for the common interests of the nation. The French were never the subjects of the king, but of the nation, Boulainvilliers repeatedly emphasizes, and I quote again, and it is absolutely contrary to truth that the character of the ancient French to imagine that they would accept a sovereign, monarchic, or despotic king, unquote. To be sure, Boulainvilliers finds predictable scapegoats, the adoption of Italian refinement and manners, the advent of female regents, one Italian, one Spanish, who, and I quote, did not only introduce the mores and politics of those nations in the heart of the French monarchy, but actually surrendered its finances and its powers to strangers, unquote. Still, the ultimate source and cause of the nobility's decline is the tyrannical monarch by divine right, who by implication can only be opposed if the nobility reclaims its rightful powers in the name of the French nation. Like Boulainvilliers, whose political impulses were reactionary, members of the Parlement, which Louis XIV had also emasculated, condemned the king's tyranny by upholding the idea of the nation. Rejecting the identity between monarch and nation, Catholic works like Fénelon's devastating letter to Louis XIV, Protestant discourses like Bell's Contrat d'entrée forced them to enter into the church, parliamentarians like Lepage, these and other voices directly and indirectly asserted an emerging ideal of the nation against an absolutistic monarch, now recast as an impure, threatening other. That an absolute nation predicated on a radical difference between us and a series of them could not then essentially exist does not, of course, mean that the impulse to forge national consciousness and identity on the backs of others ended with the age of Louis XIV. And I can't, can we turn off the light for just a second? I just want to show you this rather irresistible image, which is by Watteau, and it's the Enseigne de Guerre Sainte, which he did. It's one of the last things Watteau ever did in the 1720s. And what you see is the portrait, or a portrait of Louis XIV after his death in 1721 by Rigaud being crated. And in fact, crated, and there's even straw in the back of this picture. So obviously the crate is like his tomb, if I may say so. Thank you. Can I have the lights again? As I argued in a study of the myths of 17th century classicism some years ago, the image of this first modern era became part and parcel of French national mythology and has been perpetrated in histories of literature since the 1830s, a mythology that at this very historical moment, meaning now, of national malaise about its significance in the world, France seems determined to maintain by a desperate resort to xenophobic articulations about the non-white, non-Christian they within its porous borders. In this perspective, Julia Kristeva's Strangers to Ourselves, 1988, which examines the idea of the foreigner from ancient Greece to the end of the Enlightenment as a way of intervening against the xenophobia of advanced multicultural nation states, such as France or the United States, helps to demystify the notion of the nation as that is against its others. Christifa defines the foreign as that which is projected out of the self because it is experienced as an alien double, uncanny and demoniacal, that lies at the heart of ourself. By contrast, she envisions ourself, and I quote here, as a strange land of borders and othernesses, ceaselessly constructed and deconstructed, unquote. Thus, Christeva urges us, and I follow her here in her use of we, to discover our disturbing otherness, that apprehension generated by the projective apparition of the other, at the heart of what we perceive in maintaining as a proper, solid us, unquote. And she concludes, as I will this evening, that the recognition of the difference within us, of the them that is ultimately always already an uncertain part of us, is the ultimate condition of our being with others, anywhere, everywhere, including in the nation, which we must reconceptualize if it continues to exist in the 21st century so that its identity is no longer founded, erected, and sustained on the demonized other. Thank you. I've just been asked an impossible question, which is if I would please give a definition of contemporary national identity for Canada, so that I can compare it with what I've been doing. I'm not Canadian. I would certainly not presume to give a definition of nationhood in Canada. Maybe I would ask you to give one. Look, I mean, the point that I've been trying to work on here is really the question in which somehow nations are constructed. Obviously, this is much discussed in the United States, but what keeps troubling me over and over again is the fact that we keep positing boundaries and setting up us's and them's, and that this seems to be so important to a sense of national identity. So I'm working by negativity, if you will. It's what I don't want nation to be, but I'm not, a utopian thinker, so I haven't come across. For the moment, it seems that there are a great many negatives to nation. I understand about people needing to feel an identity, but it just seems to me that in the name of that identity, horrors are perpetrated and exclusions, horrific exclusions, are continually made and remade over and over again. We only have to look at the Bosnian War. Yes.
I have to apologize to that very rusty of the era that you've been mentioning on some of
this. I suspect most people in the room are.
I'm particularly interested in the Huguenots, and particularly as last year when I was south of Lyon, I found that the Huguenots were much more active than I ever dreamt of. Statues from the monks and churches, did all kinds of desecration.
Of Catholic places, is that what you're suggesting?
My original impression was that there were a bunch of scared people who trotted across the channel to escape persecution. Would you like to comment, please, on the activities of the Huguenots in France?
The question is about the Huguenots in France, and the gentleman says that on a recent trip to France, he saw Huguenots desecrating some statues. What were the statues of? Do you recall? What were the statues of that they were desecrating?
Minor saints.
Okay. Well, what I can say is, again, that the period in which I work is really characterized by a terrifying, I mean, I guess, you know, one hates to use the term loosely, but really by a kind of Holocaust of the Protestants in the 1680s. I think it is just, not only horrible, but also a monumental mistake. And then you have about 200,000 people spread out all over Europe, and in fact then begin to bombard the nation with all sorts of condemnations, and to the loss, of course. Now, that doesn't mean two things. Certainly, in the 18th century, there is a treaty of toleration, in the 1780s to be exact, Protestants come back, or then those who had converted, either stayed converted or came back to Protestantism. I'm not aware, maybe somebody else is in this room, what the percentage today is actually of Protestants, but surely, and thank goodness, at least the persecution of the Protestants seems to have stopped in the 18th century. Thank you. Yes. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on that?
The execution of Charles the First.
Right. I think that whole period, did you all hear the question? It had to do with the execution of Charles the First in England, who was married to a French Catholic princess. And I would say generally this, that whole period, Louis is very young at the time. So between relative by marriage, his assassination, and then the terrifying civil wars of the Fronde, which is a constant theme in my talk tonight, I think, if you will, on one level, it explains this obsession with and terror of disorder and so forth. After all, Louis, as a boy with his mother and his brother, had to flee the palace. It was that close to becoming, or they felt it was close to regicide. So it is certainly possible that, like the events in England, the wars, the civil wars in France as well, right around the same period, 48 to 53, was an overdetermined kind of cause for this kind of rigid absolutism of his reign. I think that's probably right. Would you agree with that? Yeah, thank you. Yes?
Do you think that nationalism has ever appeared as a positive force?
You know, that's a really very interesting question. Yes, the question is, do I think that nationalism ever has appeared as a positive force? And one immediate answer that comes to mind, and then one caveat after that, obviously, previously colonized or oppressed peoples, at a first stage of liberation, I think would have this sense of personhood which a nation would certainly enhance. The question is, what happens after that? And one of the things, and I'm sure we would all have lengthy explanations for it, one of the things that's so upsetting, it seems to be, about Africa is that after the period of colonialism and nation building, one is trying to find very hard, understanding the difficulties and the legacy of, you know, colonialism and apartheid. Nonetheless, it is distressing to see how repressive in many ways those, and unsupportive of their own citizens, sometimes murdering their own people, these nations are. But I would think
wouldn't shoo that there's a moment when a people that has been oppressed can be rendered as human subjects rather than objects of the oppression that must have enormously positive and can have positive. Now the question is, how do you get from there to not, you know, starting the cycle then of repression, of othering, of persecution? That's right. That's right. Absolutely. I mean, myths are fascinating from that point of view because, as we know, myths are based a lot on forgetting, and including what Americans did to the indigenous populations. I mean, right? Every, you know, Ernest Renan says that every nation is based on the number of things that they've had to forget. And there's some, it's interesting that, what have we repressed in order to be able to say that, you know, we are a nation? So do you think that there are other circumstances in which nations have affirmative? Yes. Yeah. Thank you for your question.
Right. I'll ask Professor Valerie Raoul, the director of the UBC Center for Research in Women's Studies and Gender Relations, to thank our speaker.
Thank you. I'd like to draw your attention to some of the ways in which Professor Stanton's talk, and indeed her whole career, illustrates some aspects of the critique of isolationism and boundaries, which she's been talking about, whether these boundaries are of a national nature or of several other kinds. First of all, I think that her work, and it's illustrated in this talk, is really interdisciplinary. It illustrates, I think, admirably the breaking down of barriers between several different disciplines. She is a professor of French, of comparative literature, and of women's studies, and has headed up departments in different universities in all these areas. Very few people have crossed disciplines to this extent. And her talk tonight has also shown that she is an accomplished historian. Secondly, she crosses constantly spatial boundaries and borders. She commutes on a regular basis between New York and the University of Michigan. She also commutes between North America and France. And in this talk, she brings together theory about nationhood and nation building from North America and from France in a way that very few people are capable of doing. Thirdly, she crosses historical boundaries and borders. I have heard it said, especially when I was formerly the head of the French department, that one of the things that a university maybe should not be bothering to do anymore is study obscure 17th century French authors. I think that this talk shows the relevance of looking at periods which in many ways seem remote from what we are living today. And I know that Donna Stanton's concern for minority rights in 17th century France extends very much to contemporary life. She's been very active in an organization you may know of called Human Rights Watch, and has shown in her own activities how much she cares about contemporary minority rights. I'd also think that, also almost in response to an early question, that when she talks about the paradoxical dependence of the definition of the nation on the others within it, that this is particularly relevant for Canada. I think Canada is a country which has built up its national identity on the idea of heterogeneity within it, and on bilingualism, as opposed to the purity of the language, which was dear to the heart of Louis XIV. I'd also like to remind you that Louis XIV played an important role in the myth, if you like, of the origins of the Canadian nation. You probably know about the filles du roi who came to New France in the 17th century to marry the French soldiers who opted to stay in the colony. They were called filles du roi, and the roi in question, the king who had given them a dowry, was indeed Louis XIV. And these were girls from the workhouse or taken off the streets who he considered probably part of the undesirable minority who should be got rid of. But in a sense, they are the mothers of our nation in a very important way. And we have him to thank for that. I'd also like to say that since September the 11th, none of us can think lightly about talking about them and us. And we have seen that the disastrous consequences of thinking of nations in terms of them and us, or of ethnic or religious groups, just as happened with the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in the 17th century. I think that it is very, very relevant today that we should recognize that religious or economic ideas of cultural supremacy and homogeneity are dependent on demonizing the other who isn't included. And I'd like to thank Dominic Stanton very much for making us think about those things this evening.
Thank you very much. This is my third visit to the university, and it's always a wonderful experience. You've been a terrific audience. Thank you so much.